You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, Chinese President Xi Jinping has blasted protectionism in an APEC speech. We'll look at what he said and how that relates to the signing of the world's biggest trade deal. Then,
I've done this in the teeth of the pandemic amid every other demand on our resources because the defence of the realm and the safety of the British people must come first.
Britain announces the biggest increase in defence spending in a generation. We'll examine how this reflects the changing face of warfare and what it signals about the UK's place in the world. We'll cross to Taiwan, where a pro-China television station has been ordered off the air. And
a Chinese purchaser received startlingly little change from $2 million for a racing pigeon purchased at auction from a breeder in Belgium.
We'll wrap or perhaps flap up the events of the week as Andrew Muller recaps what we've learned. Plus, we'll give you the usual roundup of the top stories in the newspapers, get a quick hit of business stories, and hear from the chair of the judges of the 2020 Booker Prize, one of the world's most prestigious literary awards, which was announced last night. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The US state of Georgia has said a recount of 5 million ballots confirms Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in the state. The European Union's Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, says he's suspending in-person trade talks with his British counterpart, David Frost, after one of his team members tested positive for coronavirus. And the Scottish-American author Douglas Stewart has won the Booker Prize for his debut novel, Shuggy Bane. More on that later in the show. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day. But first, on Sunday, 15 nations in the Asia-Pacific region entered into the world's largest free trade agreement, which they hope will accelerate the recovery of their economies in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP, was signed on the sidelines of the annual summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, held via video conference due to the pandemic. In the aftermath of the deal, the President of the People's Republic of China, Xi Jinping, gave a speech about the role China will play in solving major global crises whilst preaching the benefits of free trade. Well, Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, joins us now. Good morning to you, Isabel. This year's APEC forum is taking place online, as everything must, because of the coronavirus pandemic. It's hosted by Vietnam, but it nevertheless brings together 21 countries from the Pacific Rim, including China and the US. Combined, the participants account for 60% of global GDP. Is this gathering as important as it sounds?
Well, it's pretty impressive in terms of numbers. And of course, it does show us how economic balance has shifted in the last two or three decades. APEC has never quite managed to be a coherent forum for very much. It is a place where people meet and talk. I would guess that the trade agreement that you just been talking about, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, is probably the most significant news that's come out of APEC in a very long time. So although China is trying to forge this as a place where China leads, where the United States is absent, where we get a sense of the Asian century, within APEC, there are any number of bilateral disputes and a reluctance to forge the kind of common approach or common rules that you get, for example, within the European Union. So it's wide, it's significant, the numbers are big, but it tends to be a shallow partnership.
What's China's relationship with APEC?
Well, China, of course, is by far the biggest fish in the pond. And again, bilaterally, it has both a good and a problematic relationship with many of the countries in APEC, with some of them, with Cambodia, for example, very signed up as a Chinese partner, can be relied upon to support the Chinese position at any point. With countries like Vietnam, or increasingly with Australia, it's much, much more problematic. With Vietnam, there's 2,000 years of hostility and suspicion. With Australia, it's rather more recent, but still problematic. So China, of course, matters because of size. It matters because China's presence is both an opportunity and a threat to most of the members of APEC, so it has to be managed. They don't, on the whole, manage it collectively, and China very much prefers a bilateral relationship with all of them, where it can be by far the biggest interlocutor, and of course would not wish for APEC to gang up on China in any way, because that might change the balance a bit.
Now, Xi gave a very strong speech. What did he say?
Well, the speech was both a reinforcement of the trade agreement principles, or at least the presentation of the trade agreement. So here is China, peaceful, open, promoting global trade, leading the recovery from the pandemic. We must maintain solidarity, multilateralism matters. And all of this, of course, is a dig at the United States. I'm sure you remember that very early in his office, I think it might even have been on the first day, Donald Trump withdrew from the Trans-Pacific trade partnership negotiations that President Obama had initiated. And the TPP, which didn't include China, was very much more robust trade pact in the sense that it included things like environmental standards, labor standards. It limited government subsidies. It actually addressed a lot of the very problematic areas of trade that President Trump then attempted to deal with through tariffs, rather ineffectually. So it was, you know, a much more robust arrangement. The 11 countries that were left went ahead and signed it anyway, so it does exist, but without the United States, of course, it lacks a certain heft, but nevertheless, it's an important trade pact. Whereas China, this is China's, you know, effort to take over the space, if you like, and the speech very much was a dig at the United States without actually naming it.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I mean, given the fact that China's embroiled in a trade war with both the US and a bit of a spat with Australia too, is this talk of commitment to free trade just posturing, do you think?
Well, the other thing that was emphasized was the so-called dual circulation strategy, which is China's new buzzword about how it's going to manage the economy. And part of the promise, or part of that, is about securing supply chains against a hostile United States. You know, no more dependence on the US for high tech kind of thing. Well, that'll take a while to achieve. The other bit is to say that this is not an attempt to close China's economy off. We're going to open up more to the outside. Now, that's the promise that they're making to the trade partners in the RCEP. But it remains to be seen, to be honest. It hasn't been very convincing so far, and it seems fairly clear that China would wish its own companies to have the benefit of any growth in domestic consumption that it's been trying to stimulate. There's a bit of a wait and see on the benefits. And the other real problem within this pact is that these are all surplus-producing countries. And so it's not clear how this pact is to be balanced without the United States, for example, which is a big absorber or has been the biggest absorber of global surpluses. There's no one in this pact except Australia and New Zealand, which are too small, who can absorb the surpluses of the partners. So, you know, it largely rationalizes tariff arrangements which already existed. And it has high symbolic value, and it allows China to say, here we are, we're steady, we're here, we're leading, we're the biggest thing. But without India, which didn't join, and without the United States, it may not make a lot of difference.
I mean, how threatened do you think the US feels by the new trade alliance?
It certainly feels, I think, symbolically threatened, if it has any sense. But it's not clear that, that Biden can do much about it. There is a hostility in the United States to big trade arrangements. And I think that the argument that Trump capitalized on, which is that they're all to the detriment of the United States, goes quite deep, actually. And that is partly because of this problem that I talked about, which is who's going to absorb the surpluses. And that has been the United States. It's been the consumer of last resort. And that has been one of the big problems political problems, the feeling that the American worker lost out, that American businesses went abroad, that, you know, here we are, we're the mugs buying the goods, the cheap goods that China produces, and what's in it for us. So it'll be quite difficult, I think, for Biden to turn that around. So there is a loss of influence, or at least there's a perceived loss of influence, but it's not clear how the United States is going to be able to respond politically.
Mm. I mean, do you think that economic deals with China always have a political price?
For the United States?
Well, for anyone.
I think they have an economic price. They have a political price at the moment, I think. Very hard to enter into any cooperation with China in view of really the other tensions. So Xinjiang, Hong Kong, would be very hard for the United Kingdom, I think, right now. It's very difficult for India, partly for economic reasons. India has a $60 billion trade deficit with China and is not keen on removing tariffs right now. Besides, they've had, you know, repeated border clashes. So there are political obstacles to China's, you know, position. China likes to position itself as peace-bringing, trade, mutual benefit, global prosperity. But actually, if you interrogate this with those who haven't joined, it doesn't take long to uncover a whole set of problems. So yes, there is a political price to swallowing those problems on the promise of greater prosperity. And it's not really clear how much greater prosperity this trade pact will offer, because the basic problem within this pact has not been trade friction. You know, the tariffs have not been high in any event. Mm. The problem is structural.
Isabel, thank you very much. That was Isabel Hilton there.
Keen for a quick tutorial on where you should take your business over the coming months?
These big long-term trends make it so that we can touch every country, and we have opportunities everywhere.
Interested to learn how one of the world's biggest pharma companies responded to the pandemic?
We were able to make really far-reaching communications to enable patients to get information that they needed.
Curious about the future of air travel?
Everybody's looking forward to connect with the world, connect with friends around the world, and just spend some leisure time and some relaxing time abroad.
Or wondering whether shops will still matter.
There's thousands of different journeys through the store that anyone who walks in could take.
Join me, Tyler Brulé, weekly when I sit down with the chiefs. From CEOs to editors-in-chief, CMOs to chief strategy officers, our series is a fast-paced, intimate discussion with chiefs, big and small, from around the world. That's The Chiefs, right here on Monocle 24, or wherever you find finer podcasts.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced the country's biggest military spending increase since the Cold War. He pledged to end the era of retreat as Britain seeks a post-Brexit role in a world Johnson warned was more perilous than for decades. The funding announcement is part of the first conclusions of the government's integrated review, which looks at security, defence, development and foreign policy. Elizabeth Brough, who leads the Modern Deterrence Programme at the Royal United Services Institute, was watching the announcement carefully. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. The Prime Minister painted a rather bleak picture of the state of the world right now, implying that there are significant threats to security. What did he say?
Yes, so good morning, Georgina. That's exactly right. He not only did he paint a bleak picture of the state of security in the world, but also of the UK's capabilities, which don't match what's needed today, especially in the area of cyber and threats in space, which is where most of this money is likely to go. And that matters because the UK is very good at what's called expeditionary warfare, which is you send soldiers to hotspots around the world. But what do you do when the threats are not of a traditional kind, meaning they come from space or they come from cyber? We have seen the destruction that can be caused by cyber attacks. So that's an area where the UK will need to do a lot more, which is where some of this money will be used.
Mm. How much money? How do these figures stack up?
So it's about £16.5 billion over this time frame, and that's on top of the around 40 or £41 billion that the UK spends on defence every year. So it is a significant increase. And that's sort of in line with what we're seeing from other countries. For example, a couple of weeks ago, the Swedish government presented its new budget proposal for the armed forces. And they presented a 40% increase over the next 5 years until 2025. So that's a significant increase. But we have to remember this is... In the case of Sweden, that's up from around 1%, and in the case of the UK, it's up from 2%. So the UK is already spends a lot on defence, and now we'll obviously spend more, which will make it a star pupil within NATO.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's a very important figure, that the fact that the spend has now gone up to, I think it's 2.2% of GDP. Do you think that that's a signal to the US that post-Brexit Britain is still a valuable ally and a force to be reckoned with?
It certainly is, and it's also a signal to other countries, friendly and unfriendly. And we have to remember that the UK has a long tradition of punching above its weight. It's seen as the most... militarily capable country in the West after the United States. And it's not the second largest country in the West after the United States. So it is a country that has been punching above its weight. And of course, that dates back to times when the UK wasn't just about the UK itself, but about its colonies as well. The sort of a worldwide empire to look after. But since then, has maintained very extensive military capabilities, more extensive than you wouldn't expect for a country its size. This step essentially solidifies that position of the UK being the second most important Western country militarily. And it will certainly impress the US. I don't think we should assume that the announcement was timed to somehow impress Joe Biden. But I certainly think that the new administration will be pleased with this announcement.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about the money and how it will be spent, you've mentioned, of course, cyber, also Space Command, a lot of money going on AI. And I understand that the Navy features heavily in this.
That's right. In fact, it almost feels like the army is the only part that didn't really get anything in this early Christmas delivery. So let's spare a thought for the British Army. But the Space Force is very important, and as indeed as the Cyber Force. And what was interesting about the announcement by the Prime Minister is that it was the first official mention of the National Cyber Force, which is an offensive capability the UK has in cyberspace. And that hadn't really been acknowledged before. Now we have it from the horse's mouth, as it were, that it does exist and it will receive more money. And this is really important because when we think about cyber aggression, we usually think about, you know, how do we defend ourselves against it? But another part of the cyber battle that's waging every single day is that the countries that are attacked also have to have the capability of hitting back, or otherwise, there is no cost to the entities in the countries that attack us. So the UK does have an offensive capability. It hadn't been articulated publicly before. Now we know that it does, and that more money will be put into this National Cyber Force.
And where will the money come from? How is all of this going to be funded?
Well, that's something that I think a lot of departments are concerned about. There is obviously a lot of, I think everybody will have heard, there's a lot of concern that it will be taken from the aid budget, which would send a terrible signal. But the reality today is that the UK doesn't have a lot of money. A lot of money has been spent on borrowing. The government has borrowed a lot of money to fund the coronavirus strategy or rather to make up for lost money during the coronavirus strategy. So it's not in a financially good place, which makes this announcement so surprising. So I share the concern that some of the money will be taken from the aid budget and from domestic spending on some non-military posts, which is a bit concerning. I think it just highlights again that this was a decision, a highly political decision by Boris Johnson to keep his MPs happy, because he hasn't really been able to keep them happy lately. And strong defence is something that a lot of Conservative MPs care about.
I mean, the British Ministry of Defence doesn't have a good financial record. Do you think this can be managed properly? I mean, there are already big holes in the budget. People have questioned these figures, saying that they're not particularly accurate. So regardless of this windfall, do you think cuts are still expected?
That is a very good point. So even with this additional money, the UK won't be able to do everything it needs to do. So that raises a question: where within the Minister of Defence's budget will cuts have to be made to achieve what it is that Boris Johnson wants the Ministry of Defence to achieve? And so if I were the army, I would be a little bit concerned. I would lose some of my funds that I've had until now. And you're right, the Minister of Defence doesn't have a very good track record when it comes to using or to spending its money as it should be spent. But we also have to remember that defence spending is extremely tricky, because we're talking about major expenditures over many, many years, and where you can't see at the beginning of the expenditure for whatever the item is, the so-called platform, some major weapon systems or indeed for personnel. It's very hard to see at the beginning of the expenditure how much it will cost in the end. And of course, the reality is that the politicians who are in office at the beginning of that process may not be there at the end. So it's not really they don't have a strong incentive to be fiscally prudent. But we should spare a thought for defense fiscal heads, because it is extremely tricky, much trickier than is the case in many other ministries.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. That's Elizabeth Brough from RUSI. Now, still to come on the programme, a media storm in Taiwan and...
In the animal kingdom, winged department, we also learned of the bewildering high prices that can be commanded in certain rarefied quarters by creatures usually regarded as annoying airborne vermin.
Andrew Muller takes flight with a soaring acoustic wrap-up of the events of the week. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Taiwan has taken a pro-China television station off the air and said it would not be renewing the license of Chung Tien Television over repeated problems with bias and disinformation. Samson Ellis, Bloomberg's Taipei bureau chief, is on the line with more. Samson, thanks for joining us. What can you tell us about this particular TV station?
Well, yeah, Wednesday's decision was the culmination of a months-long battle over journalistic standards and freedom of the press in Taiwan, as well as concerns over Chinese influence in Taiwan's media landscape. Zhong Tian is among Taiwan's most watched cable TV stations and is widely seen as the most vocal supporter of unification with China, certainly among the main TV networks. And therefore, it's often quite strongly critical of the government of President Tsai Ing-wen. It's owned by Taiwan's second richest man. This is a man called Tsai Ing-ming. He moved to China from Taiwan around 30 years ago to set up what is now one of China's biggest food and beverage companies, and has in the past few years been returning to Taiwan and has made no secret of the fact that he wants to pursue formal unification for Taiwan with China. And as part of that, he has bought up a large media conglomerate to help further his aims in Taiwan, and John Tien is part of that.
And so obviously then the allegations of bias are correct.
Well, the TV station was certainly very pro-China, but in many instances did parrot the Beijing line on many issues, and was, you know, certainly the most critical of Tsai Ing-wen. So the NCC, the media or the broadcast regulator here, did say in its decision. So it was a unanimous vote among all seven commissioners in the National Communications Commission. They did cite repeated violations of broadcast regulations in four main areas. So a frequent failure to fact check news items, a high number of public complaints against the channel. I think they said 30% of all complaints they got were directed at Zhong Tian, were about Zhong Tian. There was a lack of internal controls within the newsroom, and the network's owner was involved in the editorial process. And so those were the reasons they gave for refusing to renew its license.
There have also been suggestions that the network was paid by China to spread disinformation. Is that proven in any way?
Well, Zhong Tian's owner, the Wantwant Group, and the founder, Tsai Ing-ming, he himself has admitted to receiving subsidies from the Chinese government. He has, however, said that these were given to his businesses in China. So he makes rice crackers there. He makes beverages there. He says it was given to that part of the company, and that they never made their way to, the media side of his business in Taiwan. So, but whether or not that's true or not, you know, it's practically impossible to prove. One thing that is fairly widely known here is also, for example, the Financial Times published a story last year citing several members of the company's newsroom, saying that there was a direct line between Beijing and their newsroom, and that, you know, Beijing would dictate the editorial stance they were to take on things. You know, if they weren't happy with a headline, they'd call up and tell them to change it, and they'd promptly tell it. I remember speaking to one of the government spokespeople about this last year, and they just laughed about it and said, look, if we ever tried to do that, you know, there'd be a huge scandal. You know, there's no way they comply with what we ask them to do. But, you know, Beijing just calls them up and asks them, they do it.
Can you describe the Taiwanese media landscape for us?
Well, that's definitely a very, you know, it's a very interesting landscape. It's incredibly competitive. So there is a lot of media here. It's a very crowded, competitive area. So, you know, so for a population with less than 24 million people, there are more than 10 24-hour news channels. So if you think the UK, what, has two now, I think? The US has three or four. In Taiwan, there are more than 10. There's 11 or 12 of them. So it's very, very fiercely competitive. You know, most people aren't making a huge amount of money. So that, you know, makes companies like this susceptible to, you know, needing advertising dollars from China, which obviously has a lot of money to spare. But it is broadly very, very free. So Reporters Without Borders frequently ranks Taiwan as either the freest or the second freest media environment in Asia. So broadly speaking, there's an incredibly free environment here.
And finally, Samson, how has China, which, as we know, believes Taiwan is a rogue state which must be returned to Beijing's control by force if necessary, how's China reacted to the suspension of the TV station?
Well, there's been a lot of opinion on this on all sides. So obviously, Zhong Tian themselves, they've called this ruling illegal and have vowed to pursue legal action against it. The opposition here in Taiwan has also, you know, come out against this, and they're holding a great big rally on Sunday against this. So we expect several thousands of people to come out onto the streets about this topic. And the Chinese government, they've obviously said this is regrettable, but, you know, they haven't weighed into a huge extent on this so far.
Samson, thank you very much indeed. That's Samson Ellis of Bloomberg in Taipei. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The Secretary of State for Georgia in the United States has reaffirmed Joe Biden's victory over Donald Trump in the state following a recount demanded by the president. 5 million ballots were recounted by hand, covering 159 counties in the state, which has long been considered a Republican stronghold. The European Union's Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, has said he is suspending trade talks with his British counterpart, David Frost, after one of his team members tested positive for coronavirus. He said teams for both sides will continue their work whilst following guidelines before they can meet again in person. Talks between the EU and Britain on a new trade deal from 2021 are in their final and critical stage. And the Scottish-American author Douglas Stewart has won the Booker Prize for his first novel, Shuggy Bane. The 44-year-old writer says the story's based on his own life, growing up in poverty in Glasgow in the 1980s with a mother who was battling addiction. More on that story coming up later in the show. This is The Globalist. Now, it's Friday, so of course it's time for Monocle 24's contributing editor Andrew Muller to give us his take on the week's news cycle.
We learned this week that it's still funny to us, at least, to play the Four Seasons under any and every mention of Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to US President Benito Cartman, and a lawyer who would defend you on a burglary charge by suggesting you appear in court wearing a mask and hooped shirt, toting a big bag with swag written on it, and plead not guilty on the basis that you only took all that stuff because you really wanted it. If any listeners require a catch-up, give yourself a couple of minutes to look up Four Seasons' Total Landscaping of Philadelphia, and then, if our experience is any guide, give yourselves a solid 3 weeks to intermittently convulse with laughter every time you think of it. We learned that Rudy Giuliani may be a little out of practice at the whole appearing in front of actual judges as opposed to television audiences of credulous yokels thing. His first appearance before a federal beak in some decades did not go well, although, his recent record considered, it was something that Giuliani did in fact turn up at the actual court in Williamsport as opposed to a food court or a tennis court. We learned as a consequence from the attorney representing the Allegheny County Board of Elections at the hearing into non-existent voter fraud that facing down Giuliani at this point in his career is a somewhat bemusing experience.
I sat there dumbfounded because the story that was presented by Mr. Giuliani bore no relationship to the actual complaint in the case. And, you know, when you're in court, you have to talk about the complaint. You have to talk about your facts. You have to talk about the law. When you're at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, I guess you can talk about anything.
We learned, indeed, from an equally unimpressed review from Pennsylvania's actual Attorney General that a new definition of middle age may be ability to recall Rudy Giuliani being a widely admired and respected public figure, known for responding to calamitous crisis with poise and compassion, as opposed to a frothing rodeo clown shilling hysterically for a lunatic.
You know, it's sad. It's sad to watch someone who America looked to at a time of need descend into this type of lunacy and conspiracy theory and fear-mongering in a way that's not helping this country in any way and is, again, speaking to really an audience of one. I see a man who is sad. I see a man who clearly forgot what he learned in law school, and I see a man who's got absolutely no evidence to back up the ridiculous claims that his client makes on Twitter every day.
Picky, picky, picky. We continued to learn, however, that in the special electoral college in Donald Trump's head, the president remains on track for victory. Indeed, we learned from Kayleigh McEnany, Trump's press secretary and 23rd place getter on 2022's series of The Masked Singer, that Trump anticipates re-election to the extent of planning to attend his own inauguration at the Capitol on January 20th.
It would look pretty bad if he did not attend the inauguration. It would sound like, well, look like sour grapes, wouldn't it?
I think the president will attend his own inauguration. He would have to be there, in fact.
Although, if Giuliani is organizing it, this could be quite an occasion for Capitol Dry Cleaners of Dayton, Ohio. A real business, which we took the time to look up because we know our listeners expect that kind of attention to detail. It's on Shiloh Springs Road, next to an insurance company and the fireworks shop. Despite Donald Trump's ongoing best efforts, we did learn, however, that not every American prima donna of a certain age with dubiously authentic hair and a fondness for applying makeup with a trowel is necessarily a malevolent influence.
If teardrops were pennies and heartaches were gold.
A less discerning, whimsical news monologue would be playing this item in with 9 to 5 or Jolene, but we've always had a soft spot for Dolly Parton's duets with Porter Wagoner, so that's what you're getting. For we learned that if one American vaccine turns out to be what frees us from COVID-19, we will owe a debt to Dolly Parton, $1 million to be precise, which was the amount she kicked in a while back to Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, which is a trial site for the Moderna jab. We also learned, after scouring Parton's catalogue in search of a song title we could leverage some desperate vaccine-related pun off, that the pickings on this front are disappointingly slender. You can yelp the word vaccine over Jolene, but we felt it beneath us. And in the animal kingdom, winged department, we also learned of the bewildering high prices that can be commanded in certain rarefied quarters by creatures usually regarded as annoying airborne vermin. A Chinese purchaser received startlingly little change from $2 million for a racing pigeon purchased at auction from a breeder in Belgium. The record price was earned by a pigeon hen called New Kim. And we learned that this item tied up this week's What We Learned monologue quite nicely with a neat going out where we came in device, as New Kim does in fact have something in common with Rudy Giuliani.
Didn't he do this gag a few weeks ago? Christ almighty.
Yes, it's not the only one attempting a coup. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Miller.
Yeah, I don't know why we continue to employ him. That's Monocle's Andrew Muller with What We Learnt This Week. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. And joining me down the line is the journalist and media communications specialist, Simon Brook. Good morning to you, Simon.
Good morning.
Picking up really on what Andrew was saying, of course, Trump is still trying to overturn the election. What's the Washington Post's take on this?
Well, never a great friend of the president, as you know. But according to the Washington Post, President Trump is using the power of his office to try to reverse the results of the election and try to persuade Republican officials in the states of Michigan, Georgia and elsewhere to overturn the results. And the paper reports the press conference held by Rudolph Giuliani, the president's senior lawyer, yesterday at the Republican National Committee. The theory that Giuliani is now promoting is, and along with the other lawyers, is that this is part of a centralized conspiracy with roots in Venezuela to rig the US presidential election. Again, the paper pointing out that there's no actual evidence presented for this. The paper is also reporting, as is reported widely elsewhere in the media, is streaks of what appeared to be black hair dye mixed with sweat dripping down the sides of Giuliani's face as he spoke. So it's quite interesting that a presidency and a campaign that's been quite farcical is actually now becoming quite grotesque.
Really? And I mean, I saw that television footage. Just poor man, really. And very oddly, Trump appears to have stopped dyeing his hair.
Yeah, well, there's probably a whole story here to be written about the presidential senior politician hair dye, what it means for their opinion poll ratings and their prospects and stuff. But the paper also goes to point out that the other lawyers involved in the campaign President Trump has been promoting weren't there, and neither was the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel. So I think this is continuing this theme we're seeing, where senior Republicans are sort of withdrawing from this Trump campaign, leaving just Rudolph Giuliani with his dodgy hair dye.
Oh dear, who's Delilah in this story, I wonder? Let's move on to Le Monde. And in fact, coronavirus appears to be making Macron more popular.
Yeah, so a politician here who's who's also has been sort of fighting to hold on to office, or a bit more legitimately, some people might say. But there's been much discussion, hasn't there, in the media about which political leaders have had a good COVID, if there's any such thing, and the ones that have suffered opinion poll falls and things. It hasn't been great for Emmanuel Macron. The problems with COVID came after his fight with the Gilets Jaunes, with the fuel tax protesters and things. But according to Le Monde, his opinion poll ratings are slowly beginning to rise. They've risen about 5% and are now about plus 43%. And the paper goes on to make the point that actually this is important for, well, it's important for every politician, isn't it? But particularly for Macron, because he was suffering a few months ago when his prime minister, Edouard Philippe, seemed to be stealing his limelight and getting ahead of him in the polls. Edouard Philippe was then replaced by Jean Castex. And the paper points out, Le Monde points out, that probably to President Macron's delight, he is now itching ahead. And Jean Castex isn't as popular as his predecessor, Edouard Philippe. So this is, of course, important for the whole of Europe, because Macron, along with Angela Merkel, are really the sort of driving force for the EU, aren't they? And she's had a very good COVID, as I say, if there's any such thing.
Do you think Macron dyes his hair?
He's just too young, isn't he? I mean, he's just ridiculously young at 41, so presumably he doesn't. But I have to say, he is not known for his modesty. So I imagine if he's still in office, in public office in, 20 years' time or something, I wouldn't be surprised.
Now, we could obviously link this straight to Boris Johnson's hair, but let's talk about Johnson, perhaps without referencing his blonde thatch.
Yes, exactly. So what is Thatcher's doing today? I don't know. But there's an interesting article in the Daily Telegraph by Fraser Nelson, who is editor of the Bible of the Right, if you like, here in the UK, which is The Spectator. Previous editors include
Boris Johnson.
Yeah, absolutely. and there's an interesting, I think it just shows how there's a real move here, as we've seen in the States and other countries, between those on the right who are anti-lockdown and those who are more on the left who say, no, we need to keep this lockdown and the economy will just have to take a hit. That's the way it goes. But looking at it from the prospects of Boris Johnson, of course, who's fighting for his to turn around his approval ratings and his standing within his own party, his own members of parliament. Fraser Nelson argues that there's some good stuff on the agenda here: reformed modern military, the environmental agenda, which Fraser Nelson describes as, while still radical, is perfectly plausible. But he argues, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson can't deliver on these new ideas if we keep having these continual lockdowns and the uncertainty that they bring.
Well, what does he suggest we do, though, instead?
Well, Fraser Nelson is saying that actually the Swedish model, which has been criticised over the last few weeks, well, it's always been controversial, but has particularly suffered criticism after the last few weeks. He argues that the Swedish model has been misunderstood, that it's not about herd immunity, just what the heck, let's just see who dies and who doesn't. But it's more about a voluntary lockdown that the Swedish government has levelled with the people, according to Fraser Nelson, trusted them and just asked them to do the right thing. So, as I say, it's this interesting, the libertarian, the right, let people make their decision, the left more, no, we need to government action to force people to do the right thing.
Yeah. Finally, let's look at exercise in the era of COVID-19. The FT has a piece on this.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to the gym anymore, of course, because they're all closed. But according to the FT, not a very scientific study here, but some interesting statistics to show that we are still exercising more. According to MyZone, which is a fitness tracker, users have been earning an average of almost 20% more monthly points since April, especially amongst the over 55 groups. And Peloton, you know, those spinning bike things, has almost trebled the number of people who pay for its digital fitness classes. And there's a quote from Scott Powell, Chief Operating Officer of Wells Fargo, who talks about that, how he has more time now, so he's taking more exercise. I have to say, even the paper says we're talking about a small cohort here, and it really is FT readers. I imagine a lot of other people are just continuing to sit at home and order another takeaway.
And if people are interested in Peloton, we featured that in a recent episode of The Entrepreneurs. Do you think, though, that, I mean, my experience with exercise and people in parks, I walk a great deal with a bouncy dog, and I'm constantly constantly being forced off the path by joggers without masks.
It, I have to say, in our local park here in West London, in Gunnersbury Park, it has been very controversial as well. Yes, as you say, people walking along and joggers breathing on them. It's. I think the emotional temperature has reduced slightly. Perhaps people are beginning to get used to it. But it's interesting, isn't it? It's encouraging to see more people getting out and doing more exercise. And I think, you know, one of the few good things to come out of this lockdown has been the fact that people have been getting out into their parks. But yeah, it's what is the etiquette? I don't know. That's something we'll have to work out, won't we?
Yeah, I just let the dog kind of cross their path.
Good idea.
Simon Brook, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
And it's time now to talk business with the financial analyst and Monocle 24 regular, Louise Cooper. Good morning to you, Louise.
Good morning, Georgina.
Are you a smoker?
No, never have been.
I am. I quite like your first story.
So, during lockdown, we've sort of changed what we spend our money on. We've been buying more bikes, we've been buying more jigsaws, we've been buying craft kits, things like that, and buying more toilet roll. It does seem that we've been en masse buying more tobacco. If you look at the results from Philip Morris, Japan Tobacco, Imperial Brands, Altria Group, all of which have reported in the last month, they've essentially said our industry globally is doing far better than expected. Now, of course, long-term tobacco is a declining industry, but it seems that the stress, the anxiety, the boredom, maybe even the freedom of being locked into your home has caused smokers either to restart smoking or to smoke more. Because the outlook for the industry, the sales and revenue and profits they've been reporting have been better than expected. Now, this is a slightly nuanced story because there are countries such as South Africa where tobacco sales were banned entirely because, of course, COVID is a disease that attacks the lungs and the chest. And so smoking makes it far worse. There's also issues about some places. Sales of tobacco products were considered essential and therefore you could still buy them in the shops. At other countries, sales of tobacco were considered non-essential and you couldn't buy them in the shops. France, by the way, considered tobacco an essential purchase. So there's some confusion. There's also been a bit of, you know, pantry loading, you know, stock loading like we saw with toilet roll. But also there's so many nuances to this story. Again, there's because of high tax and high prices for tobacco in most Western countries, smuggling tobacco is a massive issue. And of course, what do we know? We know all the borders closed. So again, the closure of the borders stopped a lot of that tobacco smuggling, which again boosted big tobacco profits. Mm. So this is a really nuanced story that straight away you'd think, well, COVID attacks your chest, it attacks the lungs, people would stop smoking. Actually, that's not been the case. And actually, you know, people have drunk more wine. We've seen that in the UK. People have been turning to alcohol to relieve their anxiety. It seems people have been turning to tobacco as well.
Now, that story misses out, I think, quite a key point. And this is something I'm noticing around the media. Nobody wants to report this. But if you refer to the British Medical Journal, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but it's something like this. 20% of the British population smoke. Deaths from COVID of smokers is 0.4%. 41%. It would appear that there's something in nicotine that actually prevents the virus entering the lungs.
And correlation.
Nobody wants to talk about this.
Correlation is not causality, okay? Just because two things are correlated does not mean one causes the other. There you go. I've given you a financial answer, Georgina. You would expect nothing else of me.
Yeah, well, I'll light up later. Let's talk about the cost of vaccines.
So this is a Reuters exclusive. They've talked to an EU official, and the EU official has said the European Union is expected to spend at least $10 billion on vaccines made by Pfizer, BioNTech and CureVac. Now, you think that's an enormous amount of money at $10 billion, but it's actually tiny. It's like a rounding error compared to the economic damage and fiscal cost of support packages to households and businesses. It's also, we are delighted about this, significantly less than the price that the Americans are paying, partly because, if you remember, Pfizer didn't take any money from Washington. BioNTech took German government support to develop the vaccine. So again, it's thought that one of the reasons why the EU is getting it cheaper is because BioNTech took about, I think, about $300 million from the German government to develop it. But of course, in the middle of this, and they've looked, I think they've got a copy, Reuters have got a copy of, or has spoken to somebody who's seen a copy of the legal agreement, there is an insurance policy in case, because of course Pfizer and BioNTech are American companies, there is an insurance in there that if Trump and his administration decide to divert the vaccines due for Europe back to America, there's an insurance policy that the EU will get compensation if that happens. But yes, there will be fights over the vaccines, and we have yet to see. And this is coming fairly soon, given that there are expected to be vaccines out before Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's have a quick look at the Huffington Post, which has just changed hands again.
So BuzzFeed, so this is the story of two digital news, really dominant digital news providers. BuzzFeed, that's very on social media, clickbait, they did little quizzes, they brought a whole new way of doing news, and HuffPost as well, set up by Arianna Huffington. And the two of them are now coming together, but very much BuzzFeed is in charge. The CEO of BuzzFeed is going to lead the combined business, which also always tells you. However, two weak players, and I'm talking financially weak, I'm not talking, you know, getting a lot of clicks. Two financially weak players does not make a strong one. You know, both the organizations have had to cut staff. There is concerns that putting two of them together will trigger job losses. The problem is not that they don't do what they do well. The problem is the dominance of Google and Facebook on online advertising. And what Facebook and Google know they do really well is they harvest all our personal data, which enables advertisers to target it brilliantly. And that's what advertisers want. Mm. And so although the two are coming together, two weeks do not make a strong. This again is more fuel to the fire of whether Facebook and Google should be considered too dominant.
Speaking of clickbait, I don't know if you get the newsletter Pop Bitch, but it has this wonderful thing. Question, how many clickbait journalists does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, the answer will shock you.
Oh, I love it. I love it, Georgina.
Now, that's the kind of terrible joke you might get at an office Christmas party. But of course, none of us are going to one this year.
So this is a really funny piece, actually. It's on BBC. But anyway, it's a really funny piece about how you're going to have a virtual Zoom Christmas party, as if we haven't had enough virtual, you know, events this year. Although, to be fair, it's my mum's 82nd birthday today. Happy birthday, mum. And we are having a virtual family party tonight, it has to be said, with party hats and cakes. I guess it's the same idea for the office Christmas party. I guess you all have a virtual Zoom. I think the idea is that your business, your employer, gives you a load of money to go out and buy some Christmas cake and booze and Christmas food, and you put your party hat on, your Christmas jumper on, and have a bit of a laugh. Now, I think, you know, when you think, oh no, Christmas, you know, office parties are bad enough at the best of times, a Zoom office party will be absolutely horrendous. I put it that it actually could be the solution to all your Christmas office party nightmares, because, you know, you've either going to be drunk and misbehave in front of the boss, or really misbehave and get together with, you know, Johnny from accounts, which you really shouldn't do, or you're sober, bored, and don't want to go in the first place. Your solution to all this is, my broadband is down. Sorry, couldn't work.
Very, very good idea. Louise, thank you very much indeed. Happy birthday, Louise's mum.
I'll pass it on.
This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
Funny how many people get these things wrong. I go into a lot of jazz clubs and I go, what made you build it like this? Everyone's got an opinion about design these days, but join us on a journey to cut through the noise as we sit down with some of the design greats.
It's just bloody-minded inquisitiveness, really.
We also have you covered on everything from architecture to product design to fonts and fashion too.
There's so many collections being designed. Actually, there maybe is a lifespan on a designer's role at the helm of a brand.
If you haven't already guessed it, Monocle on Design is Monocle's weekly design show. Tune in every Tuesday at 20:00 London time or find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Booker Prize is the leading literary award in the English-speaking world, which has brought recognition, reward and readership to outstanding fiction for over 50 years. Last night, it was won by Douglas Stewart. Well, the 2020 chair of the judges is the editor, literary critic and former publisher, Margaret Busby, who joins me on the line now. Margaret, great to speak to you again. We spoke briefly after the award last night. Tell us about Shuggie Bain, the book by Douglas Stewart.
Well, I don't know how long you've got, but it's a book that is really so superbly crafted and so heart-wrenching. You can't not feel for the characters. The central character is Agnes Bain, who's the mother, and her younger son, Shuggie Bain, is put in the position of trying to, in a way, save her from herself as she sort of descends into alcoholism, having been put in all sorts of difficult life circumstances, not only by her personal choices, but by the societal choices of Glasgow in the Thatcher years of the 80s and 90s. So it's something that makes you connect with Shuggie Bain, this young boy, who's, as well as trying to express his love and save his mother and look after his mother, is trying to come to terms with his own sexuality and his own feeling of otherness as he grows up as a young teenager. So it's on so many levels, it grabs you emotionally, and once you've read it, it'll stay with you. That's all I can say to sum it up.
Now, the Booker long list is 13 books. It then comes down to 6. And in the past, there have been famously fractious judging panels. And, of course, last year, the award was given jointly to both Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo. Was yours a happy panel? And was there any thought at all of splitting the award?
It was a very happy panel. I mean, the only sadness I have is that we were never able to all be in the same room for meetings or ever, because we were all in different parts of the world under lockdown. But there were no tantrums, no acrimonious anything. We connected over hours of Zoom meetings. We read books, we reread books, we discussed things, and we finally came to the decision that we wanted to give the award to Shuggie Bain, but we were also standing behind all the books on the shortlist and the longlist. And can you imagine, you have 162 books, there must be many in those books that you connect with, but you have to let them go. And in a way, one of the things, as we were coming to the long list and the short list, I was comparing it to the fact that under lockdown, one of my sadnesses, my sister died, but many of us lost friends and family, and you can't have a gathering. You can only select 6 people, and it's not to say that you don't want to hug many more than those. So, you know, there are books that, along the way, each of the judges liked in different ways. But when it came down to choosing the winner, we were all solidly behind Shuggie Bain. But we were also really thrilled that the shortlist, when we looked at it, just spotlighted so many other marvelous stories and engaging pieces of writing. I'm glad they're there. But, of course, you know, you have to stick to the rules. I mean, there's query about whether or not we would give it to one writer. We did give it to one writer.
Absolutely. That was Margaret Busby, 2020 chair of the Booker Prize jury. And tomorrow on Monocle on Saturday, we'll be talking to Samir Rahim, another member of the panel, And on Meet the Writers on Sunday, we'll be speaking to the winner, Douglas Stewart. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache, Carlotta Ribello and Paige Reynolds, our researcher, Charlie Filmer-Court, and our studio manager, Maylee Evans. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. I'll be with you giving you the news on the hour, and the briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist will return at the same time on Monday. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.